This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, good morning, everyone. My name is Mike Poyer. I'm a teacher here at Pardes, both during the year and for many years in the summer seminar. Some of us have learned together. And I'm really actually very excited about this topic in general and this morning in particular, because it's given me an opportunity to pose to myself and then, of course, to you all, a problem that's bothered me for a long time in the Tanakh. And that problem is embedded in the personality of Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel the prophet. You guys may know that the sages teach in the Gemara that Shmuel wrote three books. Any guesses on what they are? First one would be? Right, although that's a bit of a deceptive answer, because he, of course, could have only written the first, let's say, third of it, since he's dead by the time, certainly by the time you get to the second book. Nevertheless, he gets credit. The other two are? Ruth. And? Judges. Right? And if you take them together, what you see is a quite complex look at the question of kingship. So what I want to do this morning together is dig a little bit into the motivations, the understanding of Shmuel HaNavi, because even though he is ultimately the person who births, metaphorically, of course, speaking, kingship into Am Yisrael, it seems at least at the beginning that he was not in favor of it. And I believe that looking at the tension in his writings and the way the sages understood them will allow us to understand a much deeper tension in the nature of leadership in Am Yisrael at all. But before we get there, I want a little story, which I think can set this in the right light. When I was in grad school, I was in a program at Brandeis University. Anybody Brandeis out there? No, really? There's a room this many Jews and no Brandeis. Okay. Well, I was in a grad program in sustainable international development. It was a program with people from all over the world. I was actually one of five Americans and the only Jew amongst 50 people in this program, which was interesting. But we were with activists from the Third World, West Africa, Central Asia, all over the world. Very interesting. If you're curious, I can tell you about it some other time. But there was a woman in this class from West Africa, from Mali. Her name was Uri. And I became friends with her when I explained that depending on how you spelled her name, she either meant my light or awaken. And she it really like worked with her very vibrant personality. One day before class, she says to me, "You know, Mike, I really love the Jews." Which made me happy. And I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, you guys are, you're Democrats." She didn't mean big D, by the way. She meant small D. You're Democratic people. You really believe in democracy for most of your history. And so I was actually new religious at the time. And I said to her, "You know, I appreciate that, but I think you're wrong. We're actually all closet monarchists." Now, she looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, she said, "Why would you say such a thing?" I said, "Well, when was the last time you prayed for a king? Because I do it three times a day." You know, and that was a little bit of a glib answer. But as I began to think about it, I realized that it's not true. Those of you who are familiar with the traditional prayer service, which king do we pray for? Right. God is the only character, so to speak, who's called king in the Seder Tefillah, in the order of the prayers in the Shemona Atzeret. Nevertheless, many of us, and I think rightly so, if you open up, happen to have here, luckily in front of me, the Siddur, right, and in the Koran, this wonderful edition that they made, they give you the headline, so to speak, the title for each of the sections of the Amidah. And there's one called Malchut Beit David, the kingship of the house of David. And yet, interestingly enough, in that prayer, the word king is never used. The word king is only applied to God. There's a sequence here I want to touch because it's going to sort of color the learning we're going to do together. So it begins with Hashiva Shofteinu Kevarishona. Right? You're praying for what? Leadership. And specifically the model of leadership that the Seder Tefillah, the order of prayer, starts with here is judges. And I want you to keep that in the back of your mind, because remember we said that Shmuel wrote the book of Judges. And there's a model of leadership that the judges represent, which is going to run through much of the learning we're going to do, not just us with me, but throughout your whole week. This question of what the judges are is going to come back to us in a very powerful line with which the book of Ruth opens, that if you're not familiar with, we'll get to it soon enough. So it starts with judges. Question, what's the model of leadership there? It goes on to getting rid of the heretics, which is a later addition to the order, but nevertheless is very important in terms of the model of leadership which is coming. We're just going to leave it to the side for now. Then it talks about the righteous. And you can see there's a parallelism there. Right? Get rid of the heretics, bring out the righteous. Then what? The building of Jerusalem. Right? And it's in the building of Jerusalem that we hear this word, Kisei David, the throne. Another piece I want to keep on the table. What is the throne to the king? Because this is the only place that we get a little bit of hint of the actual classic, like, king with the crown and the big chair and all that. And then, and only then, right, do we talk about Tzemach David, this sprouting of the line of David. But when we talk about a melech, it's only God. Okay. That is by way of setup on the outside. What you're looking at in front of you is a source sheet which basically breaks into three sections. The first two pieces I brought, I'd like to look together briefly now. And then we'll break up and you guys do some learning here, I think, because Rav Landes is teaching the Beit Midrash right now. So I think we'll stay in here. You guys can... have you had the Chavruta talk? Have they given you the Chavruta talk about how we all get along but we disagree? And yeah, we had it? Good. So I trust you guys. So many of you have done this before. If not, I'm not going anywhere. So I'll help you out. But just to give you the big picture before we plunge into the details, the first two sources here we'll look at together now. The goal there is to get a taste of Shmuel's reaction to the request for kingship. The next section I want you guys to look at together, and it really centers around, is there a mitzvah, a commandment in the Torah, to appoint a king? And a little bit within that, what exactly, if there is a mitzvah, what does a king mean? And then the last piece we'll really look at together as a closing are simply the opening line of the book of Ruth and the closing line of the book of Judges. Because in my opinion, Shmuel was the literary master of the Tanakh, perhaps second only to the author of the Megillah, which is something that we'll speak about at 11 o'clock if you're interested. But by literary master, I mean someone whose words are meant not only to deliver information, but to evoke thought, and most importantly, to implant a narrative that lives beyond the page. Right? The goal is to draw the reader in so that they walk away as part of the story. What do I mean? Anybody know what the last word of the Tanakh is? What's that? That's the last word of the Torah, right, is Yisrael. But the last word of the Tanakh is Vaya'al. Let him go up. Okay, it's in the book of Chronicles, second book of Chronicles. Sages say that it was Ezra that wrote the second book of Chronicles. It's a discussion, description of what's called the Cyrus Declaration. Right, Cyrus, king of Persia, which we'll speak about when we get to Esther, after the destruction of the first temple, sends the Jews back home to Israel. And he says, anybody whose God is with them, let them go up. Okay, it's interesting that Ezra chose to end the entire Tanakh, the word Vaya'al. But do you know why he did that? Because that wasn't the end. It was the beginning. It's a common mistake when we read the Tanakh that we think that it's a story which is complete. But Ezra, who of course was rebuilding a people, and was therefore telling the story in a way in which when the reader finished it, they wouldn't close the book and go to bed. They would close the book and get to work. Because Vayal is actually the first word in the real story of life. Right? And in the same way, my opinion is, he learned this from Shmuel. That the way in which Shmuel both begins the book of Ruth and ends the book of Judges are setting the reader up to a very heavy responsibility, which is to craft the leadership of Am Yisrael. So, with your permission, we'll get started. Questions or clarifications before we plunge into the details here? Little historical context, where are we, right, in the narrative? God created the earth, 7 days, that part you know, right? Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, they go down to Egypt, I'm guessing you know this part, come out of Egypt, we've been reading it every week, get the Torah at Sinai, a little bit of 40-year detour, and then, who leads the people into the land of Israel? Joshua, right? Joshua leads the people into the land of Israel. Interestingly, what's Joshua's status as a leader? What is he? If you said Joshua is a blank to characterize his leadership, what would he be? A heck of a nice guy? Would he be a judge, a king, a priest, a soldier, military, generalissimo, right? It's a big question. And it's a question I want you to remember because, of course, if there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, who should have done it? Maybe him, which he does not do. Not only does he not do, he doesn't appoint any successor. So the book of Joshua ends in a very sort of triumphant, unified sense, mid-conquest. The people do not succeed in conquering. And maybe now I'll make a plug that at the end of the week I'm going to be leading the tour to Shiloh. to the ancient site where the tabernacle rested, and I highly recommend those of you who are in doubt on whether you're joining to join us there, because there we're going to see where the archaeology and the biblical narrative both come together and diverge, and how that can really, in my opinion, open up for us the depths of these stories. But Joshua, at least in the narrative, ends in a very sort of unified mid-conquest. The next book is the book of Judges. Interestingly, we're moving from person, single individual personality, to a model of leadership. Why call it the book of Judges? Why not call it? Well, the answer is clear, because nobody in that book stands out as meriting, and yet it's a model of leadership. And if you were going to characterize people, has anybody here read the book of Judges? Yeah, a little bit. If you were going to characterize the book of Judges in one word, what word would you use? Narrative. Excellent. Now, I remind you what I said about Shmuel, right? And in terms of good narrative, bad narrative, happy, sad,
failure.
Right? That's a big one. In fact, it starts off with a described system not working, chaos, like this words. And yet, what's the next book of the Tanakh? Shmuel, the book of Samuel. And what comes out of there very strongly is kingship. So we find ourselves now right here. Shmuel is depending on how you look at it, the last of the judges or the first of the prophets. That doesn't mean he's the first person to be a prophet. It means in terms of models of leadership, he holds that title. The first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of Our Fathers, says Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, and he handed it over to Joshua. Joshua to the elders, right? And the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly, who we'll speak about when we get to Esther. Right? So Moshe, Joshua, elders is a little bit confusing. Nobody's 100% sure, although the book of Joshua says there were elders that lived in his time, right? And the first of the prophets is generally understood to be Shmuel. He is the model of leadership of the prophets, which goes hand in hand, at least from him onwards, with the kings. So here we are. Somebody want to read this first source? What we are is after a very messy beginning to the book of Shmuel, where there's been a terrible defeat by the Philistines, and they take the Ark of the Covenant into captivity, and then Shmuel leads a sort of national revival, and the people defeat the Philistines, and they get the Ark back, and he kind of steps out and goes into his business. What's his primary role? He's going from place to place judging people. That's what he does. Not like, you schnook, you ought to be doing better, but meaning like sitting in court and adjudicating, right? So then the people come to him. Somebody want to read? By the way, you can read in whatever language is good for you. I ask, though, if you read in Hebrew that you translate. So I'm going to read first one. Go for it, Jim.
Now it came to pass in the days when the judges judged that there was a famine in the land.
Wait, we're looking at different sources.
Where are we?
I'm like, uh-oh, what did I do?
I went right to this one.
You need sources.
I really don't know where I am.
Ah, well, then maybe we should pause. You've got the whole book of Ruth there. That's really good to know. What else do you have in this thing? Oh, yeah? That makes sense. Somebody's thinking.
Now I understand the reason in English. Okay. And all the elders of Israel gathered and came to Samuel to Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now set up for us a king to judge us like all the nations."
Okay, pause for a second. Who is leading the charge here? Right. So it's important. We see there is an existent leadership model. What do they want?
To be like everybody else.
Okay. It's interesting. You go by the philosophical perspective that a person always says that which they want last. You guys know this? If anyone ever comes to speak to you, and they start off talking, and then this is just like one more thing I wanted to say. Be very aware. Most people, it's the last thing they say, consciously or not, that they actually wanted to say. So I think you're, what you remind me of your name? You've been here, Debbie. Yes, that's actually what I thought it was. Right? So Debbie's pointing out, what comes out here is they want to be like everybody else. And the rest of it seems to be, perhaps, kind of the path together. But what else, at least, sort of like in a formal sense, do they ask for?
A king.
Right? To do what? So now right away, fascinating, in the opening line, we have elders, king, and judge. There's a bit of confusion about what we want. And over here in the corner, like the nations. Which, by the way, if you look in the Torah, that refrain is a positive or a negative? If God says, like the nations,
negative.
Yeah, bad news, except in what, perhaps in one place that we're going to see. Yeah.
I wonder if also what he might want is in the middle, like in the end is the way to get it, because he's saying, you're old, so you need to set this up for us, and your sons do not walk in your ways. And I wonder if they want the king to judge them, so then the sons will walk in the way.
I mean, there's a sense of insecurity with the situation as it is, and what they really want is for his sons to continue on, and they're trying to find a way to get that. It's very possible. We're going to talk about their frame there in a second. It's important. Okay, so they come. So keep going, Joe.
And the thing was displeasing in the eyes of Shmuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Shmuel prayed to the Lord.
Okay, again, pause. I'm going to drive you nuts with this. Let's be specific. What bothered Shmuel?
Well, I think the notion of a king.
Was it the notion of a king?
Or they wanted him to give them a king?
Perhaps it was they're asking him.
They rejected his sons,
right? By the way, I was going to wait, but I just point out to you that everybody, with a few exceptions, right, is mystified by this paragraph. As we're going to see in a second, the vast majority of halakhic authorities say there is indeed a commandment in the Torah to appoint a king. And when we'll look at it, it seems that that's exactly what is going on here. So therefore, they all have to address the obvious question, which is, if there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, then why is Shmuel so upset? One answer might be exactly what Neil just said. It's like, what do you mean, why is he so upset? They just say, you're old and your kids are no good. Anything which follows that, just think about it. This is not a way to get what you want.
But isn't this a new model? In other words, is this a new paradigm? They haven't had a king up to now.
True, although they have the idea from somewhere, which means this might be an innocuous statement. You might be exactly, what's your name?
Linda.
Linda might be exactly right. I mean, why do they use the phrase like the nations? Not because they want to be like the nations, but saying, listen, I went to the Shuk the other day in Philistia, and I saw there's this thing called a king, and it looks like things are running well there. We want one of those, right? Well, and I think you picked up on the important line. What I was driving at is, what was displeasing him, aside from the fact that he's old and his kids are no good, gives a king to judge us. It seems, and we're going to develop this as we go through the morning, that these two elements are meant to be separate in the mind of Shmuel. And they asked for a king to judge us. They didn't ask for a king. And then if they had asked for someone to judge us, that would have been a personal attack on Shmuel. Directly, because he's the judge. If they'd asked for just the king, he said, yes, maybe so, I don't know. That's a new model, like Linda says. But what they did was they basically took a double punch. You're old, your kids are no good, and by the way, you're a rotten judge. We want a king to judge us. Okay, so I've never understood why the Rishonim don't say this. It's like very clear why. Forget if it's a mitzvah. He's hurt. He's hurt by this. So what happens? And if you want proof that he's hurt, keep reading.
And the Lord said to Shmuel, listen to the voice of the people according to all that they will say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from reigning over them. Like all the deeds which they have done from the day I brought them up from Egypt until this day, and they forsook me and served other gods, so are they going to be.
This is one of the most personal statements in the entire Tanakh in the mouth of God, I think. So like, God basically puts his arm around Shmuel's shoulder. He says, look, it's not you, it's me. You know? Exactly. They've been doing this to me. They've been doing this to me for hundreds of years, says God. Don't take it personally. It's just the way they are. Right? And there's actually something very important in that, because remember, my contention is that Shmuel's a literary master. So therefore, what you're seeing here is not just his angst on the page, although I really actually do believe that that's a big part of this section of the narrative. He's also trying to teach you something about the relationship between Am Yisrael and its leaders. Right now, for those of us who follow the weekly Torah reading, we are in the midst of the sort of leadership struggle. I have a good friend who calls the book of Bamidbar of Numbers the leadership book of the Tanakh, and most of it is negative. We just had the Great Rebellion this Shabbat of Korach stepping and to Moshe and saying, I mean, could you imagine, what was he thinking? He'd seen 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, the manna was coming down every morning. When Moshe went into the tent of meeting, a cloud descended from heaven. Like, what was he thinking that he was arguing with Moshe's leadership? And the answer is right here. That's just the way they are. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? We don't know yet, but right now he's hurt. But notice, God takes this as a rejection of whom? Himself, which implies what? Who's the real leader here? So we have a problem in any leadership model. And this is something I want you to keep in mind, is that the great, and if you are familiar with, that's going to stop eventually. If you're familiar with the Book of Kings, we'll touch on one reference in a second. You'll know that the kings of Israel had a hard time, and they weren't all successful. And I believe that the real problem was it's a trap. Because to be a king of Israel, you are one of two things. You are either a usurper, meaning you're sitting on the throne, which is meant for God, or you're a nobody. You have to completely empty yourself out and have a model of leadership, which we don't even really know yet, that we're calling king, but may indeed, like Linda was pointing out, be something completely different. So most people aren't up to that, being nothing. And so the choice you're left with is a king, and I don't know if you've noticed, politicians tend to be a little bit full of themselves, and it's part of the process of getting there. So therefore, the likelihood that they're going to fall into the sort of I'm nobody camp is very low. Right? And so we see here, God just said, anybody who's asking for a leader is rejecting me. But there's another problem with that, which is called practical living. Because God then says what? Does he say, give him a patch in the face and tell him to send him home?
Do it.
He says, do it. And the question is why? Okay. Next piece. Somebody else want to read the next piece? I won't interrupt you nearly as much. Sort of.
Maybe.
I just would point out, we are now four chapters later. And what's happened is that Shmuel has indeed appointed a king. First king of Israel was?
Saul.
Right? And there's a whole story there, which we're not going to go into. But he is, and therefore he is now sort of taking a big step back out of being the leader. And this is his parting speech. Go for it.
And Samuel said to the people, it is the Lord who made Moses and Aaron, and who brought your forefathers up from the land of Egypt. And now...
Okay. So here we are. The question that is kind of the overarching question, which I guess I didn't directly frame, but hopefully has come out through the cracks, is what is the ideal model of leadership from Israel? Is there one? And if so, what is it? And what can we learn, as I said to you, about Shmuel's attitude? Because, of course, Shmuel himself was a Navi, and that may be his vision of what the ideal model is. He was also a judge, and that may be as well. And he actively brought kingship into Am Yisrael, perhaps against his will, but nevertheless, right? And as we get to the last source, it's not so clear to me that it was altogether against his will. Okay, great. So first, the question that I sent you off with, is there a mitzvah, is there a commandment to appoint a king in Am Yisrael? What do you guys think? Well, let's actually want to start a straw poll. If you think the answer is yes, raise your hand. If you think the answer is no, raise your hand. If you cannot really tell from the sources that we looked at, raise your hand. Right? It's like, right? You guys know the milkman joke, right? You are right. You are also right. They can't both be right. You are right as well, right? Man, that's a very classic rabbinic way of looking at things. But at the same time, don't confuse rabbinic thought with the necessities of life. What do I mean? It's a very important understanding that you see here, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Noorai are irreconcilable. One says yes, it's a mitzvah. The other one says it's idolatry. But at the end of the day, that discussion in the Beit Midrash must be translated into life. And in life, you can't actually just hold both. You must do something. So if I handed you this commandment on a strip of paper and said, here you go, this just came in from God, do this now, what do you feel you are being told to do in these verses? Okay, and where do you see that ideal in these verses?
In the verses or later on in the...
No, in the verses first. We'll get to the interpretation of it.
All right, so I was basing it more on what we...
Okay, fair enough. They must have seen it somewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if this answers your question, but I get the sense that there's God's thinking to God's self. If
they want this and they don't get it, then they're going to be somehow more disenfranchised from you than they would, you know, were they to have it and have this weird intermediary situation.
So this is very important. What you're basically saying is God is, as the psychoanalyst, so to speak, has got Israel on the couch and says, if they asked for this, this is a real need. And if I don't address the need, well, it'll pop up somewhere else. And in that sense, it's very important to understand a phrase that the sages use often, which I think is the depth of which is often ignored, which is Dabar Torah b'lashon b'nei Adam. Right? It says that they say often that the Torah speaks in the language of humanity. Now, it's usually used in a technical sense, like, oh, well, why would, you know, God seems to be awful anthropomorphic and etc. But don't miss the depth of that, is that, you know, the Torah is not a work of theology. Theology are man's thoughts on God. The Torah offers itself as God's thoughts on humanity. However, who brings the Torah down? A human being. Which means that whatever the Torah with God, so to speak, looks like, it's not what's there in the book. What's there in the book is what passes through Moshe and is embodied in a way in which human beings can actually grasp and actualize it. So the idea that God has Israel on the couch, so to speak, I think is very relevant. Because the Torah, and certainly the way the rabbis engage the Torah, is a gritty realism. It's like, how could something be a commandment and idolatry at the same time? And I think you just offered the answer. You got to add, yeah? Yeah, sure.
And Sum Tassim is so ironic. It portrays a weak God. Instead of saying, you are going to do it, you're going to not have kings, you'll follow the Torah.
Right.
Sum Tassim, I know you're going to do it.
Right.
And so...
So what's his concern then? I want to get what... If you're going to do it, then what? What's the concern in those verses?
Well, then you better do it right.
Ah, right.
But that's interesting because... The kings of the other nations aren't going to go there. You're going to do it my way, period.
Yeah, God comes across as a little bit wishy-washy here.
Right.
So really, God, if we're reading between the lines...
He's a Jimmy Carter of his time.
Well, but you know, it's funny you say that, because, I mean, listen, I'm not going to get into political analysis whether you like Jimmy Carter or not, but Jimmy Carter, in many ways, was a man ahead of his time in leadership because he had an idealist vision of humanity. That if you just let people, if you facilitate the right things, people will make good decisions. Well, I can tell you as both a parent and an educator, that's just not always true. Because you know how something could be both idolatrous and a commandment at the same time? Good choice, bad motivation.
We compared it to the checkout line with children. So
yeah.
We're going to go right to check it out, and I don't want you to do candy.
Right.
But that doesn't work. So now, the next time you go through and the child says, well, I know I can only get one piece, and they only this. And then when you go home, your wife says, well, did he behave? He was great. He followed the rules. But that was the second set of rules.
Right.
So,
well, and by the way, notice, the absolutism doesn't work. And I'll tell you a secret. In my opinion, absolutism is what we call Tam Avodah Zarah. Right? That absolutism always has a little bit of taste of idolatry in it. Right? And which may sound strange to someone who is definitely an adherent of a traditional approach to Torah, but it's because the absolute is inaccessible to the human being. So, and people who worship the absolute, with the exception of very few highly righteous people, are generally worshiping a strange God which they've created for themselves, who tends to be fairly angry and plays out in his punishment of others. And I believe that that is why the argument between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Noai comes down to, of course there's supposed to be a king. Somebody's got to be in charge here. God is in charge, and he's told us to be king. And Rabbi Noai says, yeah, but I know why you want that. You want that because, what is idolatry? Idolatry is basically taking part of oneself, externalizing it, and empowering it to worship. Yeah? Well, I mean, this is perhaps too deep for us to pursue to its end. But let's look specifically at that source, right? So the Sifri says And you say, I will set a king over myself. It's very important from the Torah, through the rabbinic narrative, and of course in Shmuel, that this is all a response to the people's request. Which of course begs the question, was that if the people had not asked, was there a mitzvah to create a king? It does not seem so. And that's in fact how the Ramban and the Or HaChaim and this whole camp of the commentators who read this saying, no, listen, it's a mitzvah, but only if people ask. Or perhaps it's a mitzvah to ask, says the Ramban, which is very strange. How could something be a mitzvah to ask? Yeah, we're going to wait, because I believe that's what Rabbi Yehuda is speaking about. So look at this. You said, Rabbi Nori says, this is a disgrace, right? Because how does he know it's a disgrace? It says very clearly in Shmuel, God says, not you they rejected, but me. Rabbi Nori says he can't get around that. Yep.
That word is translated differently in two places. Can you talk a little bit about that word?
Which, disgrace?
Despise.
Well, the ma'asu,
yeah.
Something which is ma'us is literally disgusting to you. It has the connotations in the Torah is it's like a visceral sort of like you open up the door and there was a pile of vomit. like yeah, exactly. It's like this ma'us is something like very, yeah. There's no other way to put it. And I think it's important in that sense because where it does not lie is in the head. Right? This is not a political analysis that, you know, the judge prophet model is not working, therefore we need a better system. This is the people's gut feeling, and Shmuel identifies it. What's driving the request for the king in the second source we read originally? Nahash, the king, has come and they are afraid. And this is a theme you can find in many places throughout the Tanakh, is when fear is driving the bus, bad decisions are made. This is something that hopefully we all know, right? And it's something, when it comes to leadership models, is highly problematic. Highly problematic. If you just look at current events and you start seeing the types of decisions that democracies worldwide are either making or are about to make, and when fear is driving the bus, it is not the higher elements of the human being and their idealism and their aspirations for wholeness that tend to be played out. Right, so that you saw that rejection is a gut level rejection. So he says, okay, Rabbi Nori says it's clear they reject. Rabbi says, wait a minute, but it's a mitzvah. It says, right, Som Tasima Lecha Melech. You shall surely, right, and that double language in the Torah is almost always used as emphasis. You should surely appoint a king. So now he has to address, why were they punished for this in the days of Shmuel? And they weren't necessarily literally punished, although it's unclear specifically where he's reading, but it's pretty clear in the narrative that God and Shmuel were not happy. It was too early for them to ask. What does that mean? Too early. Now remember, if it was a mitzvah, then the first person who had the chance to do this mitzvah was whom? Joshua. Right? And he is hundreds of years before the events that happened in Shmuel. And okay, let's assume, what's missing there? Because in the verse of the Torah says, "Ki tavo el aretz," when you get there, which he certainly did, right? And v'yirashta, and you inherit it, which he was in the middle of the process. I pointed out to you guys deliberately that the settlement and conquest of the land was not done in Joshua's days. V'yishavta ba, and I want to get to the point that we were speaking about, right? Joshua, the book of Judges, is the book of conquest, right? But they don't finish. It seems until who reigns as the last major enemy within the land of Israel? The Philistines. And the whole story of the rise of kingship within Am Yisrael, certainly the kingship of David, is parallel to the Philistines, who, by the way, are a militaristic state.
And very successful.
And extremely successful, right? Most archaeologists believe that they were one of the remnants of the fall of the island-based Greek culture, from the Minoan, what's known as the Minoan culture, that came from, like, they settled the coast from basically southern Mediterranean corner of, like, Egypt and Eretz Israel, and had been pushing their way inland for quite some time. And that pressure was what's driving the desire for political organization on the side of Am Yisrael. Right? And that's something we'll speak about, perhaps, at Shiloh. But what's missing here is not just the Yerusha, the conquest, but Yeshavtaba. and you live there. Why does that matter? So I'll use the example I told these gentlemen earlier, right? If you walk around Eretz Yisrael, some of you guys live here, certainly you've all spent time here, I hope, right? I often find it's quite funny, especially in Jerusalem, is it seems like nothing is ever just done here. Meaning everything's either under construction, or it's like a 2,000-year-old ruin that's being uncovered. Like, where's the place that's just done? Right? Unless you think that that's just a simple matter of aesthetics, right? I want you to think about the fact that when you live somewhere, and the environment in which you live reflects back to you a sense of place, a sense of settledness, and not a sense of an imminent future in construction or a past in destruction, but rather a sense of place. The decisions you make and the culture which emerges are very different. Right? The desires that you have, which embody themselves in leadership, are very different. And it may be that when Rabbi Yehuda says, it was too early, what he's saying is, no, there needed to be this level of settling in the land. And again, that's not just aesthetics, because we're going to get, there's another model of leadership which is lurking out here. Because, of course, what would allow them to settle? Joshua was a military leader. The judges were military leaders. What was meant to follow that military leadership before kingship? Because the people jumped the gun. Nahash HaAmoni, this person that they were afraid of, that they asked for the king, was no different than Sisera, or the other enemies that Shmuel lines out. Now go back to that speech of Shmuel. He's doing a judgment with them. This one came and God saved you. That one came and God saved you. This one came and you asked for a king. What does he not say? Why is he any different? You should have just done the same thing you did before, which is cry out to God. God has proven to you for hundreds of years that he'll send you a savior. Kingship? Okay, we're not there yet. So then Rabbi Norai says, well, okay, but they only asked for a king because we institute idolatry, right? And that's that phrase, like the nations. So what's the link between a king and idolatry? I, aside from that sort of like theoretical externalization stuff that I gave you before, I think it's actually very simple, yeah? Sure. Well, you should be confused because there's no clarity here yet. Hopefully I won't leave you that way. But high level I'm a little wary of. I'm a little wary of it because it involves a hierarchy of values. I would say it's a late stage. It's late stage because, again, most of us, when we think about kings, our context is European history. Whether you're aware of it or not. If I say king, I'm willing to bet most of us picture, like, you know, the crown, the throne, the scepter, divine right, right? The king, classically in European law, is the embodiment of the state, right? That is not the model of kingship that you'll find in the Tanakh, right? Kings there, like the example we were speaking about before, right? Perhaps one of the strongest kings in the entire Tanakh is Ahab. He's the king of the northern kingdom. Even in the extra-biblical sources, we see he was a regional power. Yet there's a story, right, that he wants a vineyard that's owned by one of his neighbors, right? And if a king wants a vineyard that's owned by his neighbor, what does he do? He just takes it. Like, what's the problem? I'm the king. And yet we see, I can't do it. What am I supposed to do? And he goes home crying. And it's his wife, who was, of course, a foreign princess and idolatrous worshiper, says to him, are you a king or not? Kill the guy, take his land. That's how it works. But he has to be told that. It's bizarre. This is a person who brings idolatry into the land, who is the most powerful king we see in the biblical narrative, and he doesn't ever think to dispossess someone of their private property.
We were looking at like the context of what, like of the mitzvah and the Torah, and it's amazing because what they describe the king, it sort of reminded me of like the idea that in one pocket you say, I'm the king of the world, like the world is created for me, and the other pocket, I'm but dust and ashes. And I think the way Tanakh describes the king, like in this circumstance, like it embodies that. And you were saying it's like the nothing and everything.
I want you to hold on to that, because in the end of the day, I'm going to make the argument at the end that that is the definition of kingship in the Torah, and it has been lost because of European history and the role that we've played in it.
Is having a king, appointing a king, one of the 613, is it considered a mitzvah, at least by him?
By whom?
By
Rabbi Yehuda? Absolutely.
No, the 613, by Rambam.
Oh, by the Rambam, yes. Yeah. The Rambam, Paskins, like Rabbi Yehuda. He brings the phrase, actually, from it's the Braita from the Gemara in Sanhedrin that he brings, that there are three commandments, and then thank you for pushing us forward, right? That appointing a king, destroying Amalek, and building a temple. He brings them together. He ignores Rabbi Noari. I'm sure he had an answer to him, right? And that's the way the majority of halakhic authorities go. The vast majority. I mean, I could pull out one or two, the Bar Vanel, maybe the Ran, depending on how you read him. But the vast weight is on kingship in terms of a halakhic analysis. So the Gemara here,
just a quick follow. So if that's a mitzvah, why isn't it done?
I mean, there's a couple answers to that. First of all, there's a lot of mitzvahs that aren't done. Notice the sequence here, because back up for a second. There are mitzvot that the individual can do that there is basically no excuse. If I believe it's a mitzvah for me to eat matzah on the first night of Pesach, in today's day and age, if I don't eat matzah on the first night of Pesach, it's basically because I don't want to. Right? Unless there's obviously health or logistical circumstance. And we could come up with a way. It was impossible. But I live here in Israel. There's matzah flowing in the streets for weeks beforehand. If I don't eat it, that's on me. But if I believe that there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, what am I going to do about that? It's a social scale. And it's important to note that. And therefore, going back to that strange phrase of Rabbi Yehuda, it wasn't time yet. It was too early. Too early how? Chronologically? Developmentally? Was it that the society was not at the stage that they could do such a thing? Or was it the society was at a stage that when they asked for such a thing, well, you know, if a genie shows up in your life today and says, I'm going to give you three wishes. You can have whatever you want. You better hope it's your best day. Right? Because what I think I want today may not actually be what I realize tomorrow I really need. And indeed, we see what happens with Shaul, is the role he plays in kingship in Am Yisrael. He's what they ask for, and he is indeed what they get. And it doesn't play out well. Right? Do they ask for David? No. Nobody asks for David.
It seems to me that there's a major compromise taking place.
Uh-huh.
Because the ultimate notion of kingship can only rest with God, and that is at least
pretty clear in the nobody argues with that.
Belies that.
No.
And the danger of that is revelation. How is that perceived? How do you create any kind of a collective with that kind of a mandate?
I want to hold that, right? That there's a certain individualism. It's all well and good for me to think there is no other king than God.
Well, I'm just watching this little ant who picks up.
Oh, great. We're going there next. Okay, great.
So the fact is that ants don't work that way. We know that ant colonies are not individual. Ant colonies are the opposite. They are collective in every sense of it. So,
well, but in what sense are they collective? Correct, because that rice doesn't belong to him. What that ant lacks, actually, is individualism.
So the notion of a God-directed society, which is based on individual perception of what God wants, okay, is one kind of a place.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of a temporal authority and kingship imposed on that, at least as I'm reading it, is basically I'm being told that this isn't going to work, but I don't know what other choices you have, because if everyone is writing their own ticket, it's not going to work either.
Oh, so now we come.
So welcome to Israel.
this is not just Israel. By the way, this is the ultimate, I believe, false dichotomy which underlies human political development. So on one end of the spectrum, we have what's known politically as anarchy. Now, it's important to understand that anarchy does not mean chaos, right, as it's commonly used. Anarchy actually means the level of individual development which no longer necessitates hierarchical structures of power, right? And in that sense, there's a phrase in the Torah which makes it very clear to me that the Torah's vision is a redemptive anarchic vision, which is everyone under their own vine and under their own fig tree. Or to be less poetic about it, who is the ultimate authority in the Torah? Okay, that's nice. But you know what the reality of saying that God is the ultimate authority means? Who is the ultimate authority? You are. You know why? Because in the end of the day, you're going to have to make the decision about what it is you believe that God wants of you. Now, it's true, intermediaries will always arise. Prophets, priests, rabbis, judges, kings. Right? And here is not the time to get into the difference between power and authority to its depth, but we tend to imbue authority in those whom we see to be wise and guiding us in the ways we want to go. Power is something that others accrue that we hope that they are wise and they're actually guiding us in the ways that they go, but nobody asked us about it. And that's what this piece about the ant is really getting at. Right? If you look, and again, our time together is limited, but I encourage you to look at the 16th chapter and the 17th chapter in Devarim, right? That when the Torah talks about shoftim and shotrim, you shall appoint judges and officers. So judges, we know what they are. Right? A judge has no power, should have ultimate authority. Right? I mean, you want judges who you look to and say, why are you asking that judge a question? The answer is, well, because they know. And therefore, when they give a judgment, why do you listen to them? Well, because I believe they're right. Okay, that's great. What are the shotrim then? They're the guys with the sticks, says Rashi, that if you don't really believe they're right, then they'll come around and make sure you do it anyway. Right? For instance, anybody here ever run a red light? Oh, you don't have to raise your hand. Right? But why don't you run red lights? Number one reason you don't run red lights is? It's dangerous. Good. Safety. Right? Number two reason people don't run red lights is? You're going to get a ticket. But I don't think anybody here would say it was immoral to run lights. And we can get into the safety issue in a sense of, and there's a level of utilitarian morality in there, right? But that's all well and good for red lights, right? Once you get to questions of, I don't know, mixing wool and linen, or your sexual preference, right? Not everybody really wants somebody else dictating to them what's right and wrong. They have an inner sense of what is right. And insofar as the authority figures in your life reflect back to you, sometimes on a challenging level, but to some degree with integrity and an organic level of what you believe is right, they have authority. If they happen to have power, means they have that stick to get you to do what they want anyway, well, you can hope that they're actually reflecting back to your sense of what's right and wrong, but you can't guarantee it, because power is an external means, right? So this ant, the rabbis love the ants, right? It seems like this ant is the ultimate individual, right? It's his grain, and all the other ants realize it's his, it's not ours, so we'll go about our business until he comes back. And Joey points out, this is ridiculous. That's not how ant colonies work. Actually, the opposite is true. And what you're getting at here is that tension between the pole of anarchy, which is everybody is this highly developed individual who does not need anyone else to tell them what to do. Ultimately, the Torah wants you to know what to do. Who said it first? Moshe said it a couple weeks ago. When Eldad and Medad start to prophesy in the camp, for those of you who are familiar, they're at the end of Baalotcha, and Yehoshua says, oh, you got to throw these guys in prison. They're not allowed to say that. Moshe says, are you jealous for my sake? Oh, that it were that all of Am Yisrael were prophets. And there he let slip the misery of leadership. Moshe doesn't want to bring down the Torah and tell the people what to do. He wants to bring the people up to the mountain and let them talk to God themselves. He just knows that it's not so simple. And that if he just throws his hands up and says, well, they'll get there, odds are they won't. And so the Torah is a developmental process. Right? It's a very important, there are certain things I always try to slip into every class, so some of you guys have probably heard this from me before. It's very important to me to understand that the Torah is not an answer book. It's a common mistake that the halacha leads people toward, which is that life poses lots of questions. There are problems, and the Torah has the answers. Well, that's true on a very, very simple level, but the reality is the Torah is a training manual. It is meant, through the answers it does give you to the problems of life, to make you into the type of person who actually knows what to do. Right? And so therefore, it is ultimately looking to take authority, so to speak, out of the hands of prophets, priests, kings, and even God, and give it to you with this underlying confidence, by the way, that you can do it. However, history has proven to us that there is chaos, because there is a reason that people, when they say anarchy, most people mean chaos. The other end of the spectrum is absolutism, monarchy, right? Now, the archetype of monarchy, which you know, reaches its fulfillment in sort of divine right European monarchy is already there in the Torah. It's the story of the Tower of Babel. Right? One of the most successful societies that history has ever known. Why were they successful? They said, hey, let's build a tower to heaven. Did they succeed? Well, they would have, apparently, if God hadn't stopped them. But it was only at one price. What was that price? What was their primary building material? Bricks. You know what the difference between building with bricks and building with stone is? Building with stone, you actually have to relate to the material as it is. Well, you can shape it, but your ability to perfect it is limited. Stone has edges, it has lumps, it has inconsistencies. You have to work with the material. There is a give and take. Bricks are smooth and perfect, right? Because monarchy, in its absolute sense, works by erasing the individual. Anarchy, in its absolute sense, works by erasing the collective, right? But in a real historical process, because remember, the Torah is not theology. It's not a theoretical discussion about what could be. It's a narrative. It's a story of a people. And I don't really care if you think it's literally true or not true. It's like irrelevant because it's a story of a people. And just like your own life, by the way, is a story of your life, which we're going to come to at the end, right? You are the author of your life. Right? And we all live within these poles of the desire that somebody else should just tell us what to do. And, hey, don't tell me what to do. I have a 12-year-old girl in my house right now. I know. Right? So these ants are giving us some kind of message. And they're associated with which model of leadership? This. The judges, elders, not the king. Right? There's a level of development at which God's saying, listen, it's true what you say about ants. Certainly God knew how the ants work. But he's just saying experientially, everybody looks at the ants and they just work together and nobody's telling them what to do. That there is an ideal model of, let's just do the right thing here, people. Let's work together. Don't stop looking for somebody else to tell you what to do. That's a very simple piece in the pie here. But there's the whole other side, which is, well, everybody wants somebody to tell them what to do, right? This other piece in divine was a little bit complicated, but if you're going to give this a title, this second piece from Parsha Shoftim, Dvari Rabbah, what would you call this piece? Anybody want to put a tag on this? Trust nobody. Right? It's just, you don't rely on, you know, trust is perhaps too heavy a word. Don't rely, meaning the desire of I will set a king over myself is a desire to abdicate responsibility. And now think, if you have a society that wants to abdicate, a society of people that want to abdicate responsibility by creating leadership, what happens? Who will those leaders be serving? Presumably, right? And this is one of the big challenges, by the way, today in democracy, with the scale at which democracy has reached. I mean, America has done the best job, as I can see, of creating a democratic institution through representative democracy, where there's still some link between the electorate and their elected leaders. This country is a big problem. That once someone gets elected in this country, there's no direct connection between the electorate and the people in Knesset. Right? It doesn't matter, you don't vote for people, you vote parties, which is like another layer of problematic, right? Right now, whatever party I voted for, which will remain unstated, right, they don't care about me. I mean, in theory, if there's another election in their minds, they're going to, but there is no way in which I can close the gap between the decision I made to give my voice and the leadership there, right? There's a tremendous abdication on my part, which is built into the structure, there's not so much I can do about it. I'm saying, okay, somebody's got to be in charge. I'll choose them, right? That's on one level of government. At the same time, there's one thing to abdicate your responsibility on the governmental level, but what about on the personal level, right? And this, by the way, is not just two separate realms, because as we know, the whole philosophy of democratic protest grading into civil disobedience and et cetera, is when one decides to leverage the power of their personal responsibility to challenge the more hierarchical structures of government. You see how these two, the anarchy, monarchy, are going to go like this back and forth through history because of the reason that Joe already pointed out, which is that practically speaking, there's a scale of functioning, which what we call society, right? And even in, if you read, I don't know if you guys have ever spent any time reading anarchic philosophical political treatises, probably not because they're usually not so interesting. But the big problem that the anarchists have to deal with is the problem we all know. Who's going to build the roads? Who's going to, pick up the garbage? Who's going to organize? It could be that the Book of Shoftim is an answer to that. Now, we characterize the Book of Shoftim of Judges as a mess, that people are worshiping idols and God sends someone to punish them and then they pray and he sends to the Savior. Okay, that's great, but I'll spin it for you another way. What if actually the Book of Judges is the ideal? Which is that, listen, people need to take care of themselves. True, Am Yisrael wasn't doing so great at it all the time. But when you need someone to lead, someone will come. You want to believe it in a theological sense that God sends them? Fine. You want to believe it in a more sort of pragmatic political sense that leadership emerges out of a situation? You can look at it that way. But the last thing we need is leadership for leadership's sake. And the Book of Judges actually holds the story of the first person who was invited to be king in Israel. You know who it was? It was Gideon. Right? He has one of the great victories. If you look in the sixth chapter in the Book of Judges, this is the whole story. And the sixth chapter is the beginning. So this actually comes in the eighth. So it's one of the longer stories there. And he has a tremendous military victory. It's all great and wonderful. And at the end of it, the people come to him and say, listen, we want you to be king. Rule over us, you and your sons. Why? Because we're tired of this responsibility to do what's right. Don't forget, I pointed out to you at the beginning, the cycle is the people's spiritual status parallels their political status. That sounds nice in a theological sense. What does it really mean? If they themselves take responsibility for their lives, well, then their society will be a reflection of that. You can speak it on a socio-political level. Just think about it today in the societies you live in. If everybody in your society had a real concern with the people who live next door to them. I mean, not a theoretical one, a real one. Like, they knocked on the door. When people had needs, they were met, right? That there was a real conversation and a sense of mutual responsibility. Then the nature of government, I would argue, would be fundamentally different. Right? And so, also on the theological level, God's just saying, listen, this is why you got to be careful. That's why I don't believe the Torah has really anything to do with theology. God's saying, listen, this is how it works. Trust me, I designed the world, I know how it works, and this is how it works. You take responsibility, you're going to have a good society. In my world, says God, responsibility includes not worshiping idols and et cetera, but it also includes paying your debts and respecting your neighbor's property. And remember, the Torah doesn't make any distinction between what Western law considers to be ecclesiastic and civil law. It's all one responsibility, to be a whole human being. And then the society which emerges will be one of order. Ironically, of course, Gideon says no, and then names his most problematic son. You know what his most problematic son's name is? Avimelech, which in Hebrew means, my father was a king. So like, there's a deeper discussion to go on, and don't forget, Shmuel wrote the book. Every word in there, in my opinion, is oriented toward this problem Shmuel's got, which is that he knows that God said there's a king coming. Was it a commandment? We have no way of knowing what Shmuel thought so or not. But he had a sense that if it was going to be a commandment, it needed to come at the right time. And he had a sense when the people came to him that it was the wrong time. Why was it the wrong time? Because it was in the day that the judges judge. Ah, we've finally gotten around to our topic, the Book of Ruth, which he also wrote. Because the Book of Ruth starts with that deceptive, yeah, it was the name of the time of the judges judge. He doesn't need to mention that. Why do I care? You know why you care? Because what's the end of the book? It's the lineage of King David. And David represents the real definition of Malchut, which is that nobody asked for David. And when he is recognized as king, the people say this amazing thing to him. They say, well, you were always king. Didn't even when Shaul was here, you let us out. You brought us in. He emerges from amongst the people. And, of course, spends his whole life trying to figure out, is he in charge or not? Right? God's in charge. God's in the one time when David reaches out to take something for himself is the disaster that tears his family apart. Right? What I'm speaking about is when he takes Bathsheba and kills Uriah Hittite. Right? And as soon as he's confronted with it, he realizes he blew it. And yet, that plays itself out for the rest of his family existence. Because Shmuel is caught, and we'll end on this, Shmuel is caught in this tension, is that the world of the judges may sound nice, the sort of like grassroots, everybody do what's right, and a good society will emerge. And yet he points out that in the days of the judges, it was when the peoples judged their judges, that somehow within us is this desire to tear down anyone who presumes to stand above us, right? We all want to kill God and put ourselves on the throne. Since Adam reached out and took the fruit, I mean, like, what was he thinking, right? God said, forget theology, just go with me in the narrative. God said to him, don't do that. And the first thing he does, when God's not looking, so to speak, is, like, that isn't indicative of the human condition. It could be no otherwise, right? That we're being told that this is what it is to be human. Is that deep within us, you can take a negative, deep within us is this rotten, terrible being. And by the way, that's what leads to the desire to place someone over me who can keep me in line. Or deep within us is what? The sense of what's right. And we don't need, we don't want any external force is an idolatrous force. And therefore, I'm going to be an anarchist and know what's right in my own heart. The rabbis say that when God was mitzavem, when he commanded Adam not to eat from the fruit, that idolatry came into the world. That idolatry comes into the potential, at least comes into the world with divine command. Because in the end of the day, the human being reaches the full potential when the good rises from within. Now, reality is we can't always count on that. So there's going to be some external force, but it's going to be a tension. And that tension really is beautifully encapsulated with this last line of the book of Judges. Like, if you're wondering what's the book of Judges about, ask the author. The author is Shmuel, and he ends the book of Judges with this phrase, which repeats itself several times, lest you miss it. Right? Then the last, from like chapter 19 on, it starts to become the backbeat. Bayamim hahem ein melech b'Yisrael. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Ish and everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. Now, on one hand, you could read that, perfect. There was no need for a king in those days because everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. Anybody ever get lost in the woods? I hope not. I actually have. It's kind of scary, right? And what's the number one thing you tell people when they get lost? First thing you do when you realize you're lost is stop. Interesting. Why? Because you know what the greatest danger is? If you know you're lost and you stop, you can figure out what to do. The biggest problem is when you're traipsing away at a good pace because you're making a good time today and you are headed in the wrong direction, getting further and further away from where you want because you're going where is right in your own eyes. This line here tells you that what a king is meant to be is not to tell people what to do. Because that will always be some aspect of idolatry. And we will struggle against it and tear our leaders apart insofar as that they see that as their role. Right? The king's role, ultimately, is to hold the context for people to come to the realization of that which is right together. Because if it's everybody in their own eyes, we're going to tear each other apart and fly apart at the seams. If it's just one force from the outside, well, the individual doesn't really bear that. We're not ants or bricks, nor are we meant to be, right? And so the king has to hold that tension that Taylor pointed out, right? The phrase that I like to use is the king holds the context to allow the pieces to come to right relationship, right? And that is, I believe, the vision of kingship that comes out from Shmuel's many works. And I appreciate you guys' patience, attention, and participation in this process today, and we're going to call it right there.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.